You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren.
In the damp, foggy midnight, you snort my good pony and you give me your bed. Horse amongst the rich ones, how oft times we go there, an unwelcome guest.
I don't believe it's possible to be neutral. The world is already moving in certain directions. Wars are going on, children are starving, and to be neutral, to not take a stand in a situation like that, is to collaborate with whatever is going on, to allow it to happen. That quote of Howard Zinn began Chapter 13, Decide Which Side You're On, in Susan Rosenthal's book, Power and Powerlessness, the current section of our ongoing reading. Zinn's quote illustrates the fiction of journalistic objectivity. Journalist and author Jeremy Scahill is clear about what his role as a journalist is, to interrogate power and lay bare the truth. And he's concerned that the alternative media, which took such a strong stand during the Bush years, exposing the lies and crimes, is at risk of becoming what he calls a blue state fox during the Obama years. He spoke of this and more on December 2nd at the Park Center for Independent Media in Ithaca, New York, and we're going to hear his talk and the audience discussion in the show this week. Then we'll conclude with the next installment of Power and Powerlessness, continuing with Chapter 13, Decide Which Side You're On. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Jeff Cohen is best known as the co-founder of the media watchdog group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. He's also the founding director of the new Park Center for Independent Media at Ithaca College. He'll introduce the speaker.
I want to welcome everyone tonight. On behalf of the Park School and the Park Center for Independent Media, I'm Jeff Cohen, the founder of the center. This kind of crowd shows that Ithaca and Ithaca College really cherishes independent journalism. I want to thank the Park Foundation and Dean Diane Lynch for making the Park Center for Independent Media possible. We wouldn't exist without them. Our speaker is an inspiration, living proof that an underfunded, unembedded, independent journalist can really make a difference. His reporting has freed up documents, it's exposed wrongdoing, it's exposed murder, it's forced congressional investigations. I met him a dozen years ago when he was working in community radio, and there was this radio show that very few people had heard of called Democracy Now.
Yeah.
To borrow a phrase from Amy Goodman, our speaker goes to where the silence is and says something. He's put his life in danger covering war zones and killing fields. He was beneath the U.S.-led bombing of Yugoslavia in 1999. He covered Iraq under the Saddam Hussein dictatorship and under the U.S. occupation. He was in New Orleans in the aftermath of Katrina, and that's where he stumbled upon Blackwater security personnel doing patrols in an American city. He's won many journalism awards, including a Polk Award in the late 90s with Amy Goodman for the radio documentary Drilling and Killing, Chevron and Nigeria's Oil Dictatorship. He won his second Polk Award this year for the book Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army. That book was initially ignored by mainstream media. It became a bestseller thanks to independent media outlets. A rising tide of independent media is putting muckraking documentaries and muckraking books on bestseller lists and actually now providing a livelihood for maverick entrepreneurial journalists. Through 8 years of the Bush years, his factual reporting irritated conservatives. And in the last few months, his reporting on Obama's selections and his cabinet selections in the last couple of weeks has irritated liberals. And as he told our students earlier today, he must be doing something right. Jeremy Scahill, let's hear it.
Jeff, your check's in the mail, man. I'm going to bring you on the road with me from now on. It's really been an honor to be here at Ithaca College today, and really fun to meet students and faculty. And what a great crew you guys have on this campus. And I think you have a real treasure too, if you don't already know this, in Jeff Cohen, who recently arrived here. But as Jeff said, he and I go back about more than a decade or so. To my initial years at Democracy Now! and working in community radio. And Jeff didn't say this in his introduction, but Jeff is actually the founder of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, one of the great heroic media freedom organizations in this country. There were a handful of people that I really looked up to when I started working as a reporter, and Jeff Cohen and Steve Rendell and others at Fair certainly were among them, and we worked together on various campaigns through the 90s, not the least of which was the U.S.-led NATO bombing of Yugoslavia, where Fair really spearheaded a movement to go up against this incredibly grotesque coverage or cover-up coverage in the corporate media. And Jeff is really a media hero in this country, and really really great, I think, for the students here that Jeff is going to be here hopefully for a while. And if you do want to have information about an internship, you can see Jeff any time after class hours or something. I also have a number of friends in the audience, and the Grady family, they're a real institution here in Ithaca. And I would never dare make the mistake of trying to name all of them individually. But I got to know them when I was living and working at Jonah House in Baltimore, the community of the late Phil Berrigan and his wife, who, of course, is still with us, very much fighting, Liz McAllister. And I consider the Catholic worker movement really my home, and where many of my great friends and political allies are, and people that I very much consider to be family. And one other person I want to point out by name is Fred Wilcox. Where are you, Fred? If you can raise your hand there. I didn't even realize that Fred Wilcox had a day job. I thought he was just a professional agitator. Maybe that is part of your day job as well. But if people don't, I mean, I'm sure all of you know Fred Wilcox, but how I got to know Fred Wilcox is that he was the man who really was behind making Phil Berrigan's autobiography possible, Fighting the Lamb's War, and really worked tremendously hard on documenting this incredible life and helping to bring Phil's voice and his words into book form. And I was really honored to work a small bit on that with Fred when Phil was still with us. But for young people who really want to read the story of a true resistor, you should try to find a copy of Fighting the Lamb's War, the autobiography of Philip Berrigan that Fred Wilcox wrote with him. It's an incredible, incredible book about an even greater man. And I'm going to talk about Phil a bit in my talk tonight. I want to start by telling you guys a story that doesn't necessarily make me look good in one way, but we'll get to some part of it, I guess, in some remote way is flattering. On the evening of September 16th, 2007, I was rip roaring drunk. I was at a party with friends of mine in Manhattan, and I remember this very vividly because I had been on sort of a permanent book tour. My book Blackwater came out in February of 2007. I had spent the better part of the year on the road. I had just given a talk at the Brooklyn book festival, and I remember saying to all of my friends, you know, now I can start working on a different story. Like, I was ready to be done with Blackwater. If you saw the movie Being John Malkovich, when he walks into that room and everyone's just saying Malkovich, 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 it was like Blackwater, Blackwater, Blackwater. I used to say that I sleep Blackwater, I eat Blackwater, I drink Blackwater. Then I got in a little bit of trouble with the drink Blackwater part of it, especially in Spanish, because agua negra is sewage, so I didn't, you know, want to say that. Anyway, the bottom line here is that I was ready to be done with Blackwater and be doing something else. And so I go to the Brooklyn Book Festival, and it's like, yes, I'm done with this. And I went out with my friends, and we had a party, and it went late into the night, and I came home somehow, and I crashed on my bed. Well, I wake up the next morning around 10, 10:30, and I had like 42 missed calls on my phone, and my BlackBerry had the little, the sand and the hourglass thing was whizzing around because there were so many emails coming in at once, and the phone started to ring, and it was my colleague and friend Sharif Abdelkaddous at Democracy Now! He goes, "Where the hell have you been, man?" And he's like, "CNN has been calling all morning." I said, "This is some kind of a joke. CNN's not calling me. I mean, CNN never calls people like me. We're not allowed to the Wolf Blitzer's table or to be in Wolf Blitzer's hologram or any of the new things that they have. You know, this sort of Princess Leia moment was not to be for me." People who saw that obviously know what I'm talking about. CNN, for those of you who are Luddites or prefer not to watch television, CNN now has holograms that they can interview people on. They beam them into the Situation Room with Wolf Blitzer, and Obi-Wan Kenobi blesses the whole thing, and it's fantastic. So he says, "CNN's calling you," and I'm like, what are you, I thought it was like, I'm like, it's not April 1st, it's not my birthday, what's the joke here? And he's like, "No, did you hear what happened?" And what had happened was something deadly serious, and that is that Blackwater mercenary forces in Baghdad had opened fire on a crowded intersection of Iraqis, and at that time we didn't know how many Iraqis were killed, but it was unfolding as the single deadliest massacre carried out in Iraq at the hands of private forces from Blackwater. And so I called CNN back, and they said, "We want to have you on live at the top of the hour at noon on a broadcast that will be simultaneously on CNN and on CNN International." So, you know, I found the one suit that I have, which I had bought in Amman, Jordan, on a trip into Iraq for $5. It was a used suit, and I ironed it with an actual iron, and I remember like burning part of it with the iron, and I'm thinking, can I sit in a way where my suit's not going to, my classic Catholic worker operation going. So I end up, you know, in the limousine. You know, whenever you go on these shows, they like send a limousine for you. I go the CNN limousine from my apartment in Brooklyn to CNN's like holographic studio. You walk into the building, and it's like Anderson Cooper is like the Wizard of Oz. His image comes like careening at you when you walk in the door of this. It's seriously, if anyone can make it past the security there, you should check it out. So I go into the thing, and they cake me up with all this makeup, and I'm sitting in the chair, and you know, it's so weird when you're on these shows because you look into a camera and there's no one there except the camera, and you can sort of see yourself, and you start to kind of have these moments where you feel like you're going to faint, and I'm sitting there and I have the earpiece in my ear, and then they come to me. And what was apparent to me from like the lead into it is that whoever made the mistake of calling me that morning didn't really know who I was. They just Googled Blackwater and saw, oh, there's this guy who wrote a book on Blackwater. Get him in here. So they secretly I make it onto CNN. So here I am sitting in this chair, you know, the expert on Blackwater, and you know, and I'm sitting there, and they start by saying, you know, what is Blackwater? So I start to describe Blackwater, and I'm talking about the connections to the Bush administration and the radical right-wing evangelical Christian that runs the company, and the fact that what we just saw unfold in Baghdad is not an isolated incident, but this is the latest in a pattern of extrajudicial killings of Iraqis. And the interviewer sort of stops for a moment, and he, clearly I wasn't saying what I was supposed to say, and he said, "Well, you sound like you're very critical of these companies. You know, journalists aren't supposed to be critical. They're just supposed to tell you the facts, right?" So he and I said, "Well, yes," and I kept talking, and then he said, well, what would your alternative be?" Now, what he meant to say is, you know, what would your alternative be? Meaning, shouldn't the U.S. military be doing this job? But I, in classic, well, independent media fashion, decided to answer the question that I thought he should have asked, which is, what's the alternative to Blackwater being in Iraq? And I said, well, the alternative is immediate withdrawal of all U.S. forces from Iraq, including mercenary forces. You don't say that on CNN. Hello. Did I just? Oh, there we go. And I think that the host of the show was like a deer in the headlights moment, and he didn't quite know what to do with it. In fact, if you watch the video clip, he's sort of smirking nervously and waiting for someone to save him or something. And I decided to just, you know,
carry on, keep going. And so I said, and I think that the United States should pay reparations to the Iraqi people for the damage that we brought on that country. And he still wasn't saying anything. So I said, and you know, let me just say this. I think it shows the arrogance of U.S. foreign policy to say that we're going to dictate a future or a form of government to a people that invented the written word. The arrogance of the United States. And with that, the interview was done. You know, so I figured, you know, I'm done. The mistake was there. The cat's out of the bag. I was getting calls from people I hadn't talked to for years. And, you know, aren't you afraid for doing something like that on CNN? Like, what do you think's going to happen? That, like, Anderson Cooper and Wolf Blitzer are going to abduct me and send me to Media Guantanamo or something? So I finished with CNN. But then it's bizarre. It sort of continued. I ended up one night on ABC, NBC, and CBS on all three network newscasts in the same night. And I was on the News Hour with Jim Lehrer, where I debated the top lobbyist for the mercenary industry. And now, you know, the mercenary industry has a lobbying organization, and its name is the International Peace Operations Association. I wish it was a joke. It's just like the most Orwellian, you know, name for an organization of mercenaries. And the guy for the mercenary, their logo is a cartoon sleeping lion. Like, you know, hey kids, pack up the car. We're going to see the mercenary play on Broadway with the Sleeping Lion King or something. So I'm debating this guy, and he looks like little Poindexter, and I look like the Navy SEAL or something when you watch it, because I'm like half shaven and all this stuff. And their lobbyist is this little guy who's defending the paid killers. And I'm on the News Hour with Jim Lehrer, and it got so bad for them that they just stopped at a point providing people to debate me. And now it's not because I'm some extraordinary brilliant person or something. It's because for the first time in I think a long time, someone who actually legitimately was against the war and was able to articulate a view held by millions of people in this country was actually allowed to be in these discussions. And I took that deadly serious. I talked to many of my colleagues and my friends and people I looked up to because I all of a sudden was being invited because I happened to be an expert. They all love their experts. I was a technical expert on something, but then I was using the opportunity to also inject something that has been systematically censored. And that is what Amy Goodman says, the viewpoint of the silenced majority in this country. And so for a month, we were able, and I say we because many people helped in this, we were able to bring anti-war analysis onto the corporate media networks. And God bless Bill Moyers. He dedicated an entire hour on his program on PBS and really dissected the foundation of the company Blackwater, the extent of its operations, the use of these companies on U.S. soil. Now, lest you think that I somehow have become some kind of corporate media guy who gets called, you know, every other week, you won't see me anymore on these shows, but it sort of wasn't always that way. So flashback. I want to tell you, especially for the students here, and I talked a bit about this in class today, how I sort of ended up with a hangover that day and then on CNN 10 years, you know, 10, 15 years ago, what was going on. So I don't even have a college degree. And I was talking to people in classes today about, well, yeah, I have the rare distinction of being the first generation not to go to college in my family. It's like my brother's a lawyer, my sister has a master's degree, my dad has two. It's like, you know, and then there's me. I finished 2.5 years of college. So I wasn't good at school, but it wasn't. I remember when I told my dad I was dropping out, he wrote me this really beautiful letter, and at the end of it, it said, you know, just remember, don't ever let school get in the way of your education. They're very supportive of the whole thing. But the reason that I dropped out was not that I was just sort of sick of school and bored and wanted to leave, although I was a terrible student on academic probation from like the millisecond I stepped onto campus. But the real reason was that I was engaged in a political struggle at the University of Wisconsin campus in the mid-1990s over the rights of homeless people on the campus. What had happened at the University of Wisconsin is that the administration there made a decision that they wanted to clean up the image of the University of Wisconsin ahead of a recruitment weekend where parents were going to come and see the school and possibly send their kids there, hopefully from out of state, where they would have to pay an exponentially more than those of us that were in-state students. And so they wanted to get rid of the handful of homeless people that lived on the campus. And so they covered these heating vents that some homeless people were using to sleep on during the winter. And Wisconsin, like Ithaca, is very, very cold in the winter. And two people froze to death as a result of the administration covering those heating vents. And so a group of concerned students started an organization to try to protest the administration's policy toward homeless people on the campus and toward poor people in general in the Madison area. And we engaged in the social struggle that culminated with a two-day occupation of the administration offices at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And we were named one of the top activist campuses in the country by Mother Jones Magazine. But what I learned during the course of this process is that we could get state representatives, we could get city council people, we could get students from various walks of life to join in this and community organizations, but we could not get faculty at the University of Wisconsin to participate in the struggle because they didn't want to risk their professional lives. They didn't want to pay up personally to take any kind of a stand. And I became so disillusioned with the thought of going back into their classrooms the next semester where they're preaching at a very liberal school a social justice gospel, but when it comes time for them to actually practice what they preached, they weren't there and they wouldn't do it. And so I decided, I'm fed up with this place, I'm out of here. I didn't intend to drop out forever, I just knew I wasn't going to go back into their classrooms again. So I hitchhiked out to Washington, D.C. in 1995, and I moved into this place called the Community for Creative Nonviolence, the nation's largest homeless shelter. Now, that place has a very interesting political history that I don't have time to get into, but I arrived after the glory years of this, the political glory years, where this was a place that actually stood for something. I got there, and it was corrupt, and there were drugs, and there was violence, and it was a mess of a place. And so, not the good kind of drugs. So although it's up to your definition, you know. So I go to this place, and what I ended up doing, really, was sort of mopping floors and cleaning toilets and taking primarily Vietnam vets to psychiatric appointments or helping them fill out benefits applications for the VA. And I really got into listening to radio, and I was listening to all sorts of talk radio, conservative radio. There wasn't really, like, left-wing radio, so I thought. Listening to news radio, all this stuff. And then, wham, one day I hear this voice of this journalist talking about the Republican Revolution, and then also the next day confronting Bill Clinton's press secretary, and it was, of course, Amy Goodman. And this was before Democracy Now! Had gone in the air. And it was the first time that alternative, and I don't like that phrase, but alternative media really entered my landscape, that I'd ever heard of this. And I became a passionate listener of Democracy Now!, an active listener. It was my greatest source of information and inspiration in many ways. I couldn't believe something like this existed. And it was like a moment, and I was telling the students this today, where you open this, it's like Alice in Wonderland, you open this tiny door and you peek in, and there's a huge universe in there that you had no idea ever existed. And at the same time I was getting turned on to Democracy Now!, it was also the 50th anniversary of the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And the entire peace movement had descended on Washington, D.C. And every night in the basement of this Jesuit church in downtown D.C., you would have a different speaker. And I got to meet all these amazing people. And Daniel Ellsberg was there, and Phil and Dan Berrigan were there, and John Deere was there. All these people who were leaders in the peace movement that were in D.C. And I went every single day and night, and I got to know all of these folks from the Catholic Worker Movement. And I ended up meeting Philip Berrigan. Now, for those of you who don't know who Phil Berrigan is or are young and haven't studied him in a history book, I think it's worth telling the story because he was an incredibly important person in me becoming a journalist, and that's part of the point of this talk tonight. But Phil Berrigan was a Josephite Catholic priest who was perhaps most famous for an action that he did against the Vietnam War in 1968 called the Catonsville Nine. He and his brother, Father Daniel Berrigan, a Jesuit priest, and seven others went into a draft board in Catonsville, Maryland. You know, there was a time in this country that when there was a draft where people were forced into military service, and poor people and African Americans and people of color across the board were dying in disproportionate numbers. They were being sent to the front lines in Vietnam more than anyone else. And they went into a draft board that housed files of primarily poor and working class people. And they took hundreds of these files and put them into garbage bins and brought them into the parking lot of the Customs House in Catonsville, Maryland. And they burned hundreds of these draft files with homemade napalm that they had made from an Army field manual. And Dan Berrigan, who's an incredible poet who's still very much alive also in New York and is a dear friend, wrote a statement on behalf of the Catonsville Nine that began, "Our apologies, good friends, for the fracture of good order, the burning of paper instead of children." Goes on to say, "We could not, so help us God, do otherwise." And with this simple action, the Berrigan brothers and their seven friends who had done this action with them became some of the most notorious nonviolent resistors slash criminals, depending on who you ask, in U.S. society. And they inspired a movement of others to take this up. And, of course, the Grady family is well known because John Grady was one of the Camden 28. That was one of the actions inspired by this burning of these draft cards. Well, anyway, to make the point so that the students in the room understand what I'm talking about here. So this guy was an incredible fighter whose story, in many ways, was very much the story of resistance in this country going back to the foundation of this country. He was a modern-day manifestation of it during the Vietnam War and remained so until the second that he breathed his last breath. And so I meet Phil Berrigan, this guy, and knew who he was but didn't really know who he was. And he was telling me when I talked to him, we're building this new house in the inner city of Baltimore, and we could use a wiry young guy like you to help us with the construction. That was the phrase he used, a wiry young guy like you. So he said, why don't you come for a weekend and volunteer? And anyone who knew Phil Berrigan knows there's no such thing as going anywhere for a weekend when you're talking to Phil Berrigan. So he invites me to his house for a weekend, and I ended up staying for a year. And I spent this year doing something very... Phil was a manual laborer. He had the roughest hands of any man I'd ever met. Because he spent his entire life doing manual labor, painting other people's houses, fixing their plumbing, repairing the stairs to their house. And Phil and I almost every day would go out and paint houses together. We'd get up really early in the morning and we would drive to, paint someone's house. And occasionally someone would recognize him and say, wait a minute, are you Father Philip Berrigan? You're painting my bathroom? But this was he believed in being a working person, in doing manual labor, that was part of what makes us human, was to do manual labor. And we would spend our entire day talking. I had the most incredible political education because I spent every day for a year straight with Phil Berrigan. And it was an education that you could not pay for at a university, that you could not get from reading all the books that you could pile on a table. But to actually listen to an oral history of movements of resistance and fighters for truth and justice in this country. And ultimately, when I left that community and those folks, my vision was that I wanted to work for Amy Goodman. I didn't know Amy Goodman. I knew her on the radio. But I decided I'm going to go to New York City, and I'm going to come hell or high water, I'm going to end up working with Amy Goodman. So I engaged on a relentless harassment campaign. Well, it wasn't harassment, really, but it was a campaign of pursuit. I mean, I could have been classified maybe as a stalker in some context, but I would call Amy Goodman, and I would say, I will do anything. I must have sounded like a lunatic. I was like, if you have a dog, I'll walk your dog. If you drink coffee, I'll get you coffee. I'll wash your parents' windows. I'll wash your windows. I'll do anything. Basically, I just want to be a part of that world. And finally, after this relentless campaign, Amy Goodman agrees, when I met her in person, that she'll let me come in to volunteer one day, but she's really busy and doesn't know if she can take on a volunteer. Now, in my mind, Democracy Now, this show, must have had 40 people working for it with bureaus across the world because they were interviewing people in the mountains of the Congo, overthrowing Mobutu Sese Seko, and then having people down in Cuba reporting on the latest U.S. dirty tricks, and people from Iraq and all over the world. And I thought there must be a million people working in this place. It must be like CNN, but a left-wing CNN was sort of, in my mind, how I was thinking. So I go that day, and I remember being really nervous. I got up at 4 in the morning, and I took the subway up and went to the 35th floor of this building on 8th Avenue across the street from Madison Square Garden. And I walk into this radio station, WBAI in New York. Mind you, I think I'm going to Democracy Now, that they own the whole place. And I walk in, and there's a guy slouched over at the desk sleeping, wearing headphones, and barely was communicative about where Amy Goodman was and who she was and everything. And I walk in, and there's a picture of the Ramones up or something. And I finally find Amy, and she sticks me in this tiny closet of a room. And there were newspapers piled up and books piled up, and there was it was like an Atari 2600 or something. It wasn't even a computer, and not even a dot matrix printer or something. And I sit in this sort of closet, and she says, go through these newspapers and clip every article about Iraq. And it was a huge stack of papers. And I sat down there and diligently went through all of them and clipped every article about Iraq. And finally, Amy Goodman comes into that office. She's got a stack of newspapers, a recorder in one hand, reel-to-reel tape falling all over the place, and kind of comes in and sits down. And we're talking. And I said to her, well, where's your office? And she goes, you're in it. Democracy Now! Was Amy and one other person, basically, at the time, and then an engineer. It was like jolting. This is how this show that I listen to every day, that just sounds like across the world, more information than you get anywhere else, more accurate information, more empowering information. And that was it. It was a handful of people set in this wonderful place and complicated place and messy place, but amazing place, WBAI, with incredible people and personalities and depth of historical knowledge. And I walked into the second real classroom of my life. And I spent my time picking the brains of anyone that would sit down and talk to me. And I started volunteering for all sorts of programs on that radio station. And I became quite proficient at cutting tape, the actual physical labor of putting together a radio piece. And so some of the reporters started to ask me to help them put together their pieces. You know, these were the on-air people, and I was a guy who just happened to be good at the technical side of it. So I started working with all these reporters, and that's how I learned the trade of journalism. And that's why when I talk to young people who are interested in journalism, you know, part of what I think is important to understand here is that, yes, you can study journalism in the classroom. And I'm not saying that people should drop out of college and do exactly what I did, because I kind of fell into what I did. I didn't intend to do any of this. This is just how it worked out. But journalism should not be exclusively a thought of as a profession or a career. In fact, I think that's the wrong way to look at journalism or a field of academic study and research per se. What it should be is a working person's job, a working person's way of living. Very much like being a plumber or being an electrician, you learn it as a trade or through an apprenticeship. That to me is the best way to learn this, because it's also the most organic way to learn it. And you understand that the whole point of journalism, in the broadest sense, should be to take information and put it into a form that's accessible to people and that's going to mean something to their lives. Politically, what journalism should be is that you give voice to the voiceless and you hold those in power accountable. And in the process, you try to paint a picture that the person who hears your report or reads your report or watches your report, you're painting a situation or introducing them to the people that they may never meet, but you want them to feel as though they know them as human beings, particularly in the case of people who are victims of wars that emanate from the shores of the United States of America. That's our role and our responsibility as journalists. And that was what I learned through the process of being around people that believed that. It was a way of life to them, that they weren't there to make the big bucks, because you don't make the big bucks for the most part in journalism, and you certainly don't make it in community journalism. I called a good year making $14,800. Look, coming out of the Catholic Worker in Jonah House, when my income hit five figures, I was like, look at Mr. GQ Smooth now. Bought a new pair of shoes, not gotten from the Catholic Worker basement. So you know, I mean, I thought you know, the first year that I had any health care, I was like, wow, I have hit the jackpot. I have health care in this country. I'm one of the rich people or something. But my point here is that, you know, I spent most of my time as a journalist working for free. I mean, I'm a terrible businessman as it is, and I don't even want to think of myself ever in that context. But the great thing about that, the great thing about being willing to live sort of on the fringes of society in a sense, or, you know, living in, I mean, at Catholic Worker places or crashing on couches or what have you while you're a journalist, if you're not someone motivated by money or you're not in a situation in life, and some people are, where they don't have that luxury, they have to have an income, they're supporting someone, or they themselves are in a situation where they can't. But I happen to be in a situation where I didn't really care about money. I don't come from money. My parents never had to give me money. But the point I'm making to you is that my whole passion, the whole thing I lived for, was to be a fighter for justice in the context of journalism. Journalism was my nonviolent weapon. That's how I saw my role in the broader struggle for social justice around the world. And, you know, I was honored to go with Amy Goodman to Nigeria in 1998, and we did a documentary about the Chevron Oil Corporation's involvement in the killing of indigenous Nigerians, and we got Chevron on tape admitting that they had provided their helicopters to the Nigerian military to carry out this massacre of indigenous Nigerians. That was in 1998. Last night, a verdict came down in the lawsuit that originated as a result of the reporting that we did. These Nigerians from the Niger Delta sued Chevron, one of the most powerful corporations in the world, an economy larger than many nation states around the globe. They sued them. The Center for Constitutional Rights represented them. Chevron had the most powerful, high-powered corporate attorneys on planet Earth defending them, and unfortunately, Chevron was found not liable for the killing of these activists. Now, they're going to appeal it, But you know, to me, that story that we did was one of, if not my proudest moment as a journalist, because we went to a place where there wasn't running water, where illiteracy was rampant, where the only white people that these folks in the Niger Delta had ever met were oil people coming to steal their most precious resource. And the idea that we were able in some humble way to communicate their story, first on community radio, but then ultimately in congressional investigations that were sparked as a result of it. And thank goodness for Dennis Kucinich and the Congressional Black Caucus who made that possible. And but it's also it's a story of how long it takes to even get your moment if you get it. 10 years it took for these people to have their day in court. And it was almost as though Chevron was able to throw enough money at it to try to make it go away. But they're going to continue that fight. And out of Nigeria, then I scrounged up money and I ended up going to Iraq in 1997 with the great human rights activist Kathy Kelly and Voices in the Wilderness, and went with them on a humanitarian delegation. And what I saw in the hospitals of Iraq in the 1990s, when Bill Clinton was president, would forever change the way that I viewed the world and viewed my own country. Because the United States was waging an undeclared war against Iraq in the 1990s that doesn't exist in most history books because it was almost uncovered in the corporate media. But the United States waged for the entire duration of Bill Clinton's presidency in the 1990s an economic war against the civilian population of Iraq, where they essentially blockaded the country and made it so that they couldn't import basic medical supplies and foodstuffs and other humanitarian supplies. As punishment for Saddam Hussein remaining the leader of Iraq. They collectively punished the people of Iraq, and that combined with the fact that in the 1991 Gulf War, the United States had destroyed the civilian infrastructure of Iraq, bombed water treatment facilities, and polluted the environment, meant that hospitals throughout Iraq had a deadly cocktail of contamination of their environment, which caused skyrocketing rates of cancer, and then they didn't have the medical supplies to treat the diseases that they were facing, the illnesses that they were facing. And I went almost always when I was in Iraq, the place that I spent time more often in than not were the hospitals of Iraq. And they were like death rows for infants, where you would have doctors that would say to you, I'm a doctor and I have my medical degree from Oxford. I have a patient here who has this ailment. The difference between my patient and myself is that I have a white coat and I know what I could do if I had the tools to address this medical situation, but I can't because I don't have those medical tools. And so you saw children dying. You saw kids born with congenital malformations that didn't exist in modern medical journals. You saw mothers wailing when their ultrasound determined that they had a child inside of their womb, a baby inside of their womb that was going to be born without a brain because the father was a veteran of the Iraqi military exposed to U.S. depleted uranium munitions in the south of Iraq. Now, some of this, for some of you who may not have studied that history or are younger, it may sound like I'm talking about, you know, ancient history. This just happened a decade ago that was U.S. policy. And the people that implemented that policy are now once again in power because Barack Obama has rehired all of these people to run U.S. foreign policy. You know, the correct term for a group of hawks is a kettle of hawks. Obama has hired a kettle of hawks to run U.S. foreign policy. People whose records we know well, whose histories we know well, who are not unproven characters, we know who they are, and they have been wrong about so much for so long. Barack Obama campaigned on a pledge to not only end the war, but to end the mindset that got us into war. And his campaign said that on the premier foreign policy issue of our generation, John McCain and George Bush were wrong, and I was right. And Obama said it repeatedly, and Biden said it repeatedly, and Greg Craig said it repeatedly, and the campaign put out press releases that said this. Why then, and this is a question that President-elect Obama should be asked repeatedly until he answers it honestly and accurately. Why then, President-elect Obama, have you hired a team of people who agreed with George Bush and John McCain and disagreed with the 130 members of the House of Representatives that voted against the war, the 23 senators that voted against the war? There is not a single person who was a true opponent of that war that has been tapped for a senior position in the foreign policy apparatus of Barack Obama's administration. We have Hillary Clinton, who was a passionate supporter of the war in Iraq, so passionate that she felt it responsible to represent the people of New York by promoting the lie, not only that Saddam had weapons of mass destruction, which she did in her speech supporting the war, but became one of the only Democrats to go so far as to say there was an Iraq Al-Qaeda connection. Hillary Clinton voted yes on the war. Joe Biden, Barack Obama's running mate, not only voted for the war, but was the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee in the summer of 2002 when the Iraq War was being debated. And Joe Biden refused to call any witnesses for that hearing. He could have called anyone he wanted on planet Earth. He refused to call any witnesses who would dissent from the dominant parameters of the game. And they were set like this: bomb the hell out of Iraq or bomb the hell out of Iraq and send in ground forces. Those were the parameters of the debate. At the time of those debates, when Biden, who's going to be our vice president, was running the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, I was traveling around the United States. I had just come back from Iraq with Hans von Spanik, 32-year veteran of the United Nations. He was an assistant secretary general of the UN and was the head of the Iraq program at the UN, who had just resigned in protest because of U.S. policy there. Hans von Spanik had just returned from Iraq, from the north of Iraq, where he observed Ansar al-Islam guerrillas, the so-called al-Qaeda presence in Iraq that was being used to say that there was a connection between Saddam and Iraq. And what Hans von Spanik would have testified to, and we tried, and we called Biden's committee, and we begged them and pleaded with them and sent them letters and faxes and emails, he would have said that he met with them, and not only are they fighting Saddam Hussein's regime, but they're doing so from the safety of the U.S.-controlled area in the north of Iraq. They wouldn't call this man, who had a record of 32 years of being a diplomat at the United Nations. Scott Ritter, the former chief UN weapons inspector, Jeff was with him at the time and pushing for him to be brought before that hearing, knew more about the dismantling of Iraq's WMD program than any other U.S. citizen, and was no leftist and was no dove, and would have testified gladly on what he knew about Iraq's lack of a WMD program. They refused to call Scott Ritter. So not only did Joe Biden, Barack Obama's agent of change vice president, not only did he vote for the war, he held the hearings that facilitated the war. Susan Rice, who is now the ambassador at the United Nations, who's called the leftist in the bunch. Susan Rice, first of all, is one of the most vocal proponents of bombing Sudan over the Darfur issue. But secondly, she claimed she was an opponent of the Iraq War, but she herself promoted the myth that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction when it mattered most, when she was a pundit on national media outlets in the United States. General Jim Jones, who is Barack Obama's national security advisor, a close friend of John McCain. Jones is a career Marine military commander who led one of the first Marine incursions into Iraq, says he was against the war but never said it publicly, said he was against the neocons but never said it publicly, said that he would almost resign but didn't resign, and currently sits on the board of Boeing, a big war contractor, and Chevron. Robert Gates, and this is my favorite, Barack Obama could have picked anyone he wanted to be defense secretary. He could have gone into the list of foreign policy experts who were right from the beginning. And what he chooses to do is to keep on the man President Bush selected as his defense secretary. And it's not just that Gates has come out opposed to some of the things that Barack Obama has talked about with Iraq. It's that Gates is a known quantity. He's an old CIA spook who cut his teeth during the Cold War, who was also involved with tainting intelligence at that time, and has a fairly scandalous history himself. The point I'm making here, and I could go on, but I'm not going to do that, with naming these people and talking about their records, is that when I write about this now, and I say, well, let's look at not the rhetoric. I'm sick of listening to that speech. I want to look at the records of these people, their history, because that's our clearest indication right now of what an Obama presidency is going to look like. I have never been so inundated with hate mail in my life. All these people who loved me when Bush was president, who would invite me to be on their radio shows or write for their magazines, they're furious right now. Why? Because what we're seeing is a sort of blue state fox emerging, where you have people that they're not really, really interested in journalism. They're interested in partisan journalism. They're interested not, it's not left journalism. MSNBC is not left-wing TV. MSNBC has turned into Democratic Party television. And once again, people like myself and Jeff are going to be boxed out of that dialogue again. Because when it's the Republicans, boo, hiss, Bush is a war criminal, fine, let's have Jeremy Scahill on the show to talk about Blackwater, a Republican company. But, oh, it's Barack Obama, the man who's going to change the universe and lead us to the promised land. Don't you dare say anything critical about Barack Obama. I don't make ad hominem attacks on Barack Obama. I'm simply stating the facts. We know who these people are. Let's talk about their records. So I felt it necessary now to start putting at the bottom of every article I write an updated bio that says, Jeremy Scahill pledges to be the same journalist under an Obama administration that he was during Bill Clinton and George Bush's presidencies. The reason I'm doing that is because, once again, we see the spines of so many journalists and pundits and others being surgically removed by themselves. They somehow have managed to rip their own spines from their body and check them at the door until the next time a Republican is in office, where they'll conveniently find it and reinsert it. This is a crisis right now of journalism in this country, because when the journalists start being the partisans, everything to look like Fox News. And really, really, when we talk about it and we're intellectually honest about it, what is the real difference between what Fox News does and what blind Obama followers do on their media outlets? Is it that we like Obama more? Is it that he's closer to what we envision as a just world? Or is it that now we're sort of taking sides with power because it's power that we like a little bit more, or power that we believe in a little bit more? Because let's be clear on something. It's not just the people. Barack Obama did not run as a progressive. That's a mythology that somebody somewhere created. He didn't run as an anti-war candidate. That's some mythology people created and that the propaganda machine for the Obama campaign reinforced. How many of you have actually read Barack Obama's alleged speech against the Iraq War in 2002? Has anyone actually read it? I'll quiz you, so be honest. Okay, a couple of people. Because in that speech, Obama says, he calls the war stupid. He doesn't exactly come out forcefully against it. He gives a sort of pragmatic bent on the war. You could give him, you know, you could give him credit and say, yes, he was criticizing it. Okay, maybe he was against it. But Obama five times during that speech says, and of course, I'm not against all wars. Obama is a guy who believes in a militaristic, interventionist, hegemonic foreign policy. He is a status quo Democrat when it comes to the foreign policy apparatus of the United States. And I don't think that Obama would actually disagree with that if it was an honest conversation. His followers are the ones who have created the mythology of Obama being the great hope for the progressive movement. Those of us who actually read his platform know the following. Barack Obama does not intend to end the occupation of Iraq. He's going to downsize it and rebrand it. He will withdraw combat forces of Iraq, withdraw U.S. combat forces from Iraq. Maybe he'll do it in 16 months. I would doubt that very seriously. He's even indicating that that may not happen. But he's going to keep in place what he keeps calling a residual force. Next time you watch Obama speak, watch for that term, residual force. He intends to keep a force of U.S. troops in Iraq and in the region, could number from 20 to 60,000, for the foreseeable future after he's done with his withdrawal plan. He says he will not rule out using Blackwater and other mercenary companies and will not sign on to legislation or endorse legislation to ban the use of these companies in war zones. He uses the rhetoric of the Bush administration to describe the Iraqi resistance, calling them Al-Qaeda, and saying that we are going to continue U.S. presence in the region to, quote, strike at Al-Qaeda in Iraq. Obama has made very public his intent to portray Afghanistan as the good war, and he's going to escalate that war and is going to put well in excess of 10,000 U.S. troops beginning in February. Already, President Bush has adopted Obama's plan for Afghanistan. And Obama says this as a good thing, that Bush is finally taking his Afghanistan plan and escalating the war in Afghanistan. Obama says he will use unilateral force inside of Pakistan to defend U.S. interests, which is a very dangerous statement and a precedent to set before you've even taken office. Obama uses the rhetoric of the war on drugs and a militarization of the war on drugs, which ultimately plays into the hands of right-wing forces in Latin America, counterinsurgency forces, and U.S. mercenary companies that are making a killing off of the war on drugs in Latin America. Obama's speech at AIPAC last summer was one of the most inflammatory speeches ever given by a U.S. presidential candidate. It went further than President Bush in its hawkishness on Israel. where Obama said during that speech that he wanted to have a unified Jerusalem as the capital. That's further than Bush has gone, and it's further than even some of his own speechwriters who are neocon AIPAC people would have taken it. And by the way, who wrote his speech? Dennis Ross, one of the best-known neocons, who has been, in the words of one who worked under him as Middle Eastern envoy, he was Israel's lawyer, even though he was technically working for the United States. He was one of the primary authors of Barack Obama's AIPAC speech. And in that speech, Obama made it very clear that he would be more than willing to use military force against Iran if Israel's security was being threatened. There are other disturbing aspects of Barack Obama's foreign policy, not the least of which is a pledge to actually increase the military budget, expand the size of the permanent U.S. military, and ensure that the America First doctrine is going to remain the law of the land when it comes to U.S. foreign policy. Now, the reason that I'm saying all of this is because if George Bush, if we rewound to 8 years ago, I would be talking about who Bush was appointing, and he appointed a bunch of crooks from the Reagan era and the Bush era. And this is how the White House works. You recycle all these people that are so wrong about so much, and it happens every 4 years or every 8 years. You have a recycling of these same people. But we have to be consistent with how we view power if we want to call ourselves journalists. And that means that we're probably going to be very unpopular with a lot of people oftentimes in our lives. But if there aren't journalists in a society that are willing to be consistent, that are willing to look past who we like or who might be closer to what we like, but actually say we're going to treat power as power because that's our job in a society that purports to be a democratic society. That's truly what it means to be a journalist. And there we have great and courageous journalists in this country. When you look, Jeff and I were just talking about this today. When you look back to 10 years ago, the media landscape out there, it was a much more bleak scene in a lot of ways because you didn't have the vibrancy of the web. Now, I have a two-edged sword. If your only connection to the real world is your internet connection, you have a serious problem. But I think there's a danger in becoming too connected to the blogosphere as sort of your way of dialoguing with the rest of the world. We need to get out and back into the streets. But it is important that we've built up these institutions. There are great muckraking websites like Talking Points Memo. And Huffington Post, while it's sensational at times and sort of tabloidy, Huffington Post has a real service, particularly during the election campaign, because it made certain information accessible and it brought the viewpoints of many of us who would never have an audience with a certain sector of U.S. society. It brought our writings because we were mixed in with some gossip stuff about Tom Cruise and Britney Spears and all that stuff. So, but my point here, we have a very vibrant media landscape, but it's precious. And those of us that have worked in community media know that the front line is we have to defend what we already have. That means defending our cable access stations and our public access stations in communities across this country. Young people in particular, students, you know, I mean, this is a different generational reference because I'm 34 now, but, you know, if you ever watch that movie Wayne's World, you know, you think of like cable access as like Wayne's World or some bizarre thing where like a monkey is riding a unicycle and juggling and, you know, slapping his feet against a wall or, you know, bizarre stuff that's on there, like a devil worshiping ceremony in the middle of the night. But the reality is that if it wasn't for cable access or television, University Now wouldn't be on 700 radio and TV stations around the country. There wouldn't be that opportunity for people in local communities to build a local program that could come before or after Democracy Now that deals with local issues of a social justice focus. The same is true of community radio stations in this country. They are some of the best training grounds for the journalists of tomorrow and some of the best sources of information and disseminating information in communities. You know, the purging of Bill Moyers from PBS a few years ago was a startling moment for a lot of people because it showed how far those in power will go to knock out any voice of independence that starts to gain traction. And while PBS now is sponsored by, you know, Sesame Street is sponsored by, you know, the letter Z for Zyrtec and all that stuff on the, you know, the corporate sponsorship, we still have to defend it. We have to defend Pacifica Radio, but we also have to build other media institutions. And the challenge for young people is not to think in terms of a corporate mindset of the world, but of that kind of apprenticeship program. Tap Jeff Cohen, ask him what kinds of opportunities are available. Become a part of that struggle. If you believe that you want to be a journalist, it has to be a fire that burns in your heart. But you can also start at the university level or at the college level by getting involved with community media in your community and at your campus. Because if we don't defend these institutions, if we don't start building independent media outlets, if we don't preserve the integrity of those we have built, and that's a real crisis right now, the danger of it becoming partisan versus actual journalism, if we don't defend it, it'll all go away. And one of the great lessons that I hope we learned over these past 8 years is how much we desperately need independent media in this country at a time of war, when civil liberties are under the gun, when the Pentagon is talking about deploying 20,000 troops on U.S. soil, when the war is being outsourced and mercenaries are brought into New Orleans and secret prison sites are being run throughout the world by the United States, and we have a torture program called the Extraordinary Rendition Program, and we have Guantanamo, and hopefully it will be closed in the first 100 days of that administration. What a stain on this country throughout the world. But when we live in these circumstances, when there's such a bipartisan chorus of voices proclaiming the extension and the further extension of the U.S. empire, we need honest journalism. We need people willing to stand up. And my two favorite quotes in life, one of them comes from, two of them actually come from Dan Berrigan, and I'll throw a third in there from another guy I talked about today, Ammon Hennessy, and this is how I'm going to end, and then I'd be happy to take some questions. But, you know, Dan Berrigan, when he was talking about Dorothy Day, the founder of the Catholic Worker Movement, when she passed away, Dan Berrigan said about her, she lived as though the truth were true. She lived as though the truth were true. And I think it's a beautiful, beautiful statement, because the truth is what really matters. It's not about being popular. It's not about consensus building within a party somewhere, a partisan entity somewhere. It's actually about standing up for what's right. That actually does matter. The ultimate form of defeatism is saying, well, he's the president. Let him decide. Give him a chance to do it. No, that's not democratic. There's a history where patriotism in this country means being a dissident, means standing up when it's not popular to do so. It means living as though the truth were true. And the second quote from Dan Berrigan, and I think it's particularly relevant to all of us in times such as these, and especially me because I can blabber all the time, is don't just say something, stand there. Mean what you say by actually putting your body somewhere where it matters that it's actually there. Whether that's being embedded with civilians who live on the other side of the barrel of the gun that is foreign policy, or it's standing in silent vigil, or it's standing with someone who's being harassed on the streets, or is being victimized by racism, standing there and putting your body there. And the quote that I'll end on comes from the great anarchist pacifist Ammon Hennessy, and I told some of the students this today when he was picketing decades and decades ago, 100 years ago, in front of the White House, and someone came up to him and said, and he had been a war resister in prison for refusing to fight in the military, I believe, during World War I. And he's standing in front of the White House, and he's holding a picket sign, and someone comes up to him, a group of people, and they say, Mr. Hennessy, you know you're not going to change the people inside of that building, meaning the White House. And he said, well, you may be right, but they sure as hell aren't going to change me. And Ammon Hennessy and others that came after him understood that there actually is a tremendous value no matter how small of a group of people we are. And in the course of the world, we are actually the majority that believe that it is important for there to be a conscience of this country that is represented in the streets and in the independent media movements and in halls like this across this country. Thank you very much for being here.
You're listening to a talk by journalist and author Jeremy Scahill, given December 2nd in Ithaca, New York. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Benner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren.